This is VOA News via remote. I'm Michael Brown. The African-American man who died in police custody in the state of Minnesota, setting off global protests against police brutality and racism, was buried next to his mother Tuesday in his home state of Texas. George Floyd died May 25th after Minneapolis police arrested him on suspicion of spending a counterfeit $20 bill in a food store. A white police officer who kept his knee on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes, even after Floyd said he couldn't breathe, is charged with second-degree murder. Three other officers at the scene are charged with aiding and abetting. There are also calls across the country for cities to defund and reform police departments. President Donald Trump is being criticized for sharing an unfounded conspiracy theory suggesting that an older protester police push to the ground last week in Buffalo, New York, could have been an anti-fascist provocateur trying to disrupt police communications. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo condemned Trump's tweet, saying he should apologize for his mean and reckless words. The 75-year-old man remains hospitalized, and the two officers who pushed him are charged with assault. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the president's highest profile authority on coronavirus pandemic, described COVID-19 as his worst nightmare. On Tuesday, the New York Times said he made the comment in remarks broadcast to a group of biotechnology industry executives. Fauci said the speed at which the disease moved around the globe was surprising. For more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com, or on the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. Hong Kong police say 53 people were arrested when thousands of protesters ignored a police ban to mark the first anniversary of the city's anti-government movement Tuesday night. Earlier in the day, hundreds also staged protests in seven shopping malls across the Asian financial hub at lunchtime. The throng of demonstrators chanted pro-democracy slogans and displayed banners saying Hong Kong independence and liberate Hong Kong, revolution of our times. Intending to stamp out protests, China's legislature in late May passed a plan to force sweeping national security laws on Hong Kong to prevent and punish acts and activities that threaten national security, including advocacy of secession, subversion, terrorism, and foreign interference. Asked by reporters about the year-old protest movement, Hong Kong's leader, Carrie Lam, said everyone needs to, in her words, learn a lesson from the challenges, and people should understand that Hong Kong cannot cope with chaos. Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza died after suffering what the government said was a heart attack 2 months ago before he was scheduled to leave office. He died at a hospital Monday. Burundi's constitution says the president of the National Assembly replaces a president who dies, but there was no immediate word Tuesday on when the assembly leader might take office. Nkurunziza's wife is ill, recovering from coronavirus at a hospital in Kenya. The illness triggered rumors that the president had caught the disease as well. Nkurunziza's handpicked successor won last month's presidential election. In a statement Tuesday, Human Rights Watch says Nkurunziza ruled Burundi through fear and crushed dissent. Voters in five U.S. states went to the polls Tuesday for political party primary elections, but the balloting in the southern state of Georgia was slow, voters reporting long lines and officials saying there were problems with voting machines not working. Elections also were held in Nevada, South Carolina, North Dakota, and West Virginia. The spread of the coronavirus pandemic here in the U.S. has pushed the state election officials to institute new measures to allow absentee voting by mail, even as President Trump has contended without evidence that mail-in voting will lead to widespread voting fraud. For more news, please join us, voanews.com, or on the VOA mobile app. Via remote, I'm Michael Brown, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundians are mourning the sudden death of their president, Pierre Nkurunziza.
He has lived his life mainly for his country. He will always be remembered as a highly respected Burundian politician of all time.
We'll talk with an analyst about the late Nkurunziza's legacy. A former Sudanese government militia leader is taken to the ICC to face trial. Liberian President George Weah orders his country's international airports to reopen, but is it ready? And the people of Malawi will probably know by the end of today, Wednesday, the date for their court order fresh presidential election.
Today, what will happen in Parliament? The leader of the House is going to move the House to allow the bills to be tabled. And then the Minister of Justice, Honorable Brighton Sata, is going to present all the four bills. And they'll be debated by the House, and the resolution will be made at the very end.
Victor Musowa is a member of Malawi's Parliament. And COVID-19 is threatening food security in Nigeria. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Burundians are mourning the sudden death of their president, Pierre Nkurunziza, who, according to the government, passed away yesterday, Tuesday, after suffering a heart attack. He was 56. The government has declared a week of mourning. Nkurunziza ruled Burundi for 15 years, marked by alleged human rights abuses. Diomande Misigaro is a Burundian living in the U.S. city of Nashville, Tennessee.
I can say that was honestly a shocking moment. There was no sign of him being seriously sick. When a friend of mine called me and told me the news, I couldn't believe my ears. But we all know that one way or another, we need to respond to God's call, and it was his turn. He has lived his life mainly for his country a lot. He will always be remembered as a highly respected Burundian politician of all time. So many good things happened under his rule, especially for those Burundians who did not have votes. He tried and gave his best to many of Burundians in need of education, healthcare, and peace and security in general for all. May his soul rest in peace. He's a big loss for many other Africans, and for sure his legacy will not be forgotten.
What do you know happened to the late president? According to the government, he seemed to be in good health. He was admitted to a hospital overnight on Saturday. Later on, he was feeling well. We do know also that his wife is being treated in Kenya, probably for coronavirus. So what do you all know might have happened? Do you think it could have been coronavirus?
All we have and what we can read from the government notice is that he had a heart attack. As of coronavirus, I don't have any clue. These days, anybody who die of anything else is tend to be corona. So I stand by what the doctor say. It was heart attack. And as of the wife, honestly, I don't have any of the medical record or any information on where she is or what she suffered of. But probably we'll get more details.
Burundi just had elections and President Nkurunziza was to step down. What do you see as the future of Burundi politically?
It's really sad that bad things are happening very fast now while we're waiting for the possession of the power. But good news is that at least president-elect has been confirmed. So we are happy for sure that everything will be fine. What he's going to miss is the transition. The only thing is he's starting by those bad news. I know for him, Burundian know that he's a strong man, and I know he will do his best. The future of Burundi politically, I don't think there will be many problems. We have another generation, mainly people who have been working closely with him, and for sure they are ready to step in.
Diomande Misigaro is a Burundian living in the U.S. city of Nashville in Tennessee. The late Burundian president, Pierre Nkurunziza, joined politics during Burundi's bloody civil war in the 1990s and served three terms as Burundi's president beginning in 2005. His decision to run for a controversial third term in 2015 set off protests and violence that left hundreds dead and prompted hundreds of thousands of Burundians to flee the country. Nkurunziza was due to step down in August after his chosen successor won 2020 presidential election that opposition candidates said was unfair. For more on Nkurunziza's legacy, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke to International Crisis Group's Nekeli van der Waele.
It's a bit mixed, to be honest. When you look at Pierre Nkurunziza, I think what he represented during his reign was really the Bush generation that fought during the Burundian Civil War, that came into power after Burundi's troubled post-colonial era. That's a bit mixed. But then what we also see is that Nkurunziza was not able to keep the party united during the 2015 political crisis. So there was an attempted coup d'etat in 2015. Nkurunziza decided to try for a contested third term, which he won. Then the rest of his reign was characterized by human rights violations. So a lot of people had to flee the country. Civil society actors were unable to act. International media and national media found it very difficult to operate. So that really divided and scarred the country. But then on the other hand, you can also see that at the end of his term, he was willing to step down. So in January, his party, the CNDD-FDD, elected a new candidate for the presidential elections, Evariste, who was indeed elected 2 weeks ago in the elections. And that's why we can say it's a bit of a mixed legacy, because despite what happened before, he seemed willing to step down in the end.
And now looking forward, he was already going to be leaving power, but he wasn't going to be leaving entirely. Now that he has passed away, what impact might that have on the political situation in Burundi?
I think that's a bit too soon to tell. He was indeed supposed to leave office on the 21st of August. Now what we see is that there will be, the president of the National Assembly will be president at interim. So in this period between the elections and the new president Evariste assuming office. But Nkurunziza, indeed, he was supposed to become the supreme guide of patriotism, meaning that most people expected him to remain influential despite a new president assuming office. It remains to be seen what happens next.
That was Nekeli van der Waele of the International Crisis Group. She was speaking with viewers Jason Pantinki. The International Criminal Court said Tuesday that one of the four Sudanese government militia leaders, Abu Qushaib, is now in the court's custody. Qushaib is accused of commanding Janjaweed militia that attacked Darfuri villages in 2003 and 2004. The ICC issued a warrant for his arrest in 2007, accusing him of 22 counts of war crimes and 28 counts of crimes against humanity, including killing, rape, and torture of civilians. Three other Sudanese government commandos are still wanted by the court, including former President Omar al-Bashir. For more, viewers Jason Pantinkin spoke to Suleiman Baldo, a senior policy analyst at the New York-based Enough Project.
Office of the prosecutor, Ms. Fatou Bensouda, issued a statement moments ago in which she confirmed that Ali Qushaib has surrendered himself to authorities in the Central African Republic and that the authorities of the Central African Republic have transferred him to the custody of the International Criminal Court. This confirms media reports that started circulating in overnight, and now Qushaib is effectively in the custody of the International Criminal Court and will stand trial according to the rules and regulations of the court for the alleged crimes he has committed in Darfur during the genocidal campaign of the regime of Bashir between 2003 and 2004.
Can you explain for our audience who exactly is Ali Qushaib? Why is he so important and why has he been wanted by the ICC?
Natalie Kosheb actually worked as a nurse in the medical corps of the Sudanese army when the events of Darfur started in 2002-2003. He was recruited as a tribal militia, have proven particularly vicious and atrocious in the conduct he displayed towards civilians that were targeted by the governments of Sudan. So he rose to the rank of commander of the Janjaweed during the genocidal campaign of 2003 and 2004. And the court issued an arrest warrant for Ali Kosheb back in 2007. However, that was still, dictator Bashir was still in power and protected Kosheb, so he continued to commit, atrocious crimes. When Bashir was deposed in April of 2019, Kosheb basically remained free, roaming, around. He got worried after the government in February of 2020 said it was ready and willing to cooperate with the ICC in relation to the indictees of the court in Sudan. He fled into Central African Republic with several hundred militia fighters, joined armed groups there in the Central African Republic. And for some reason that is not clear to me at this time, he decided at one point last week, actually, to surrender to the authorities.
He's been a wanted man, an internationally wanted man, for well over a decade at this point. What's the significance of him finally going into custody of the court in The Hague?
The significance of all of this is that, however delayed, justice will always arrive, and that it will help to maintain the call for justice for the victims of the genocide in Darfur. There are upward of 2 million victims who are still in camps within Sudan, and they are not finding justice in their own country. For them, this would be an indication that they will have their day in court, starting with the step of the trial of Ali Kosheb. This will also give legitimacy to the role of the ICC at a time when it's coming under a lot of pressure, including from the Trump administration, which is threatening to basically target the ICC. And it's a reminder that the international system still needs a court of last resort when governments cannot or are unable to deliver justice for their own citizens.
Suleiman Bordeaux is a senior policy analyst at the New York-based Enough Project. He was speaking to viewers Jason Pantikin. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, June 10th. Malawians will know by the end of today, Wednesday, whether their special court order presidential election rerun will take place June 23rd or July 2nd as the parliament meets to debate a constitutional amendment bill to set the date to the fresh elections. In February this year, the country's constitutional court annulled the 2019 presidential election results because of irregularities and ordered fresh elections. The bill proposes that the fresh election be held June 23rd, as recommended by the Malawi Electoral Commission. But there was drama yesterday when opposition members of parliament voted without debate that the election should take place June 23rd. Victor Musuwa is a member of parliament from the ruling Democratic Progressive Party.
Today, what will happen in parliament, the leader of the house is going to move the house to allow the bills to be tabled. And then the Minister of Justice, Honorable Brighton Saka, is going to present all the four bills. And they'll be debated by the House, and the resolution will be made at the very end.
There was an article on Tuesday suggesting that Parliament had approved June 23rd as the date for the special presidential election rerun. So can you clarify for us what exactly happened in Parliament?
To say Parliament has passed a bill suggesting the voting day to be the 23rd, that's not true. I think these bills, the government has already made communication to Parliament through the Business Committee starting on Monday. And by Monday, everybody in parliament knew that there would be bills coming. And one of those bills talks of the voting date, and the voting date being the 23rd of June. So that being the voting date today in parliament, when the leader of the House made the announcement that the bills have arrived in the House, some members in the opposition stood up to suggest that because we know the voting date in the bill is on the 23rd, why can't we allow the Malawi Electoral Commission to gazette the date before the bills are passed, so that we rush in gazetting the date. At the end of the day, that was irregular, because there's no way a bill that hasn't been passed by the House can be gazetted somewhere else. So whatever we were doing, some members wanted to introduce today, was an irregular motion that cannot surpass the bill. You know, what is needed to happen in Malawi out of the four bills is to change a constitution. So the constitution will be amended in four sections of the constitution. That constitution can only be amended by the House and by two-thirds. And that will be happening today. So the Tuesday discussion was not a bill at all. There's nothing like that. It was a proposal by some honorable members. So government protested that because it was complete irregular. And you know, Tuesday is a government business, and the business was supposed to be tabled by government. This government already made communication to say on Wednesday, being another government business, we are bringing the bills. There's no need for someone to propose that Malawi Electoral Commission should start to gazette a date that is not passed into a law.
You said that President Mutharika has submitted four bills to Parliament. What is in each of these bills?
According to the resolution of the court, the orders that were made to Parliament suggest that Parliament does 3 or 4 weeks to pave way for the fresh elections to happen. One of it is to set the date, because our constitution already has a date of the third Tuesday on the month of May. That's when the elections are supposed to happen. So Parliament has to set a specific date for these current fresh elections. Second, Parliament has to amend the sections that allow members of parliament who voted together with the president and the councillors.
Victor Mutsubwa is a member of Malawi's parliament from the ruling Democratic Progressive Party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lilongwe. Liberian President George Weah says the country's Robert International Airport will open to commercial flights beginning June 21st. Mr. Weah made the announcement June 5th, saying the country has made progress in containing the coronavirus pandemic. He said the state of emergency, which expired yesterday, June 9, will not be renewed. But as Moses Gatia will report from Monrovia, Roberts International Airport seems to have some challenges.
It has been nearly 3 months since the Ravos International Airport was closed to commercial flights due to the coronavirus pandemic. The managing director of the Liberia Airport Authority, Bishop John Allen Clay, says preparations are on the way for reopening.
We are very excited about the mandate from our president that we should see reason to open the airport. Modalities have been worked out with not just the airport, because, you know, it entails us working with WHO, the Ministry Health, MPHIL, and the rest of the guys who are responsible, especially for the preventive measure of passengers that will be landing here.
Bishop Clay says, despite excitement over reopening the country's own international airport, there are challenges that might slow the full operation of the airport.
We are coming back, but we are coming back with nothing, because not the same amounts of flights we had before we now return the same time. Maybe we'll have one as we progress through, and we are thinking about the strength of our employees, who everybody will want to come to work, but yet we only have one flight, or we don't have a flight yet.
He said despite the closure, the airport remains fully functional to relieve flights, something he said even depleted the resources of the airport and will need government intervention to help with the return to normality.
We were still 100% operating the airport with relief flights and medical flights, and we were still paying our employees, and even if the airport is closed, it's not close to other flights, and our equipment and other things we have here, we still have to make sure that they are on, and we've been encouraged. foreign is expensive or without the landing of flights. And these flights that land there are really flights with no payment.
Even small business owners in the vicinity of the airport have been affected by the closure. Elijah Botwin is in a foreign exchange business. He also sells mobile recharge cards at the airport. He says the coronavirus crisis and the closure of the airport have somewhat collapsed his business.
It's not that very down, but anyway, we're going to visit home, so we just have to force it and come on the airport to manage let us up. But it's been hard for us for the 3 months.
Yeah, tell me, because why my little money now, it's been out to do business with everything I come.
I can start like over now because I need to go get my brother, my sister, and the credit before I can start like right now. It's not easy.
Emmanuel Gibson runs a local restaurant and a bar near the airport. He said he's excited about the reopening pronouncement, but he thinks it might be a risky undertaking by the government.
We're going to be looking at other countries, our neighboring countries. We've got to look at the cases. My case is very low, but in other countries, my cases is very high. If I open my restaurant, I'm happy. I see everybody come in. I'm making the money. But in making the money, I get in problem. I will get sick, or somebody from around me get sick. So I'm not so happy.
Liberia might be the first West African nation to open its airport to international travelers, but does it have in place the proper control measures, especially as coronavirus cases have been rising in recent weeks? Currently, there are 383 cases, with 31 new cases reported as of Monday, June 8th, in the country. Moses Gazio, VOA News, Monrovia.
The World Food Program warns that COVID-19 pandemic is threatening food security in Nigeria's large urban areas, as well as conflict-affected communities in the unstable northeast. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Nigeria, Africa's biggest economy and most populous country, is reeling from the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. A steep drop in international oil prices, Nigeria's major export since the outbreak of the coronavirus, has sparked fears of a recession. Nearly 12,500 cases of coronavirus, including 354 deaths, are confirmed in Nigeria. The United Nations reports lockdown measures aimed at containing spread of the deadly disease could result in as many as 13 million job losses if the restrictions go on for very much longer. The World Food Program warns this would unleash a situation of widespread hunger in a country where some 90 million people live on less than $2 a day. In response, the agency says it plans to scale up its operations to feed 3 million of the neediest people. WFP spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers says among those who will benefit from the program are city dwellers in Kano, Abuja, and Lagos, who are particularly hard hit by the socioeconomic knock-on effects from COVID-19. Others who will receive increased food and nutrition support, she says, are women, men, and children affected by a decade-long insurgency in the northeastern states of Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe.
We are concerned about conflict-affected communities in the northeast Nigeria who already face extreme hunger and who are especially vulnerable. They are on life support and need assistance to survive.
Beer says WFP is distributing a two-month supply of food and nutrition assistance in camps for displaced people to make sure they have enough to eat during the COVID lockdown period. She says WFP is providing technical support to strengthen government-run social protection programs. These include feeding programs for some 9 million children who are missing out on meals because of COVID-19 school closures. The agency is urgently appealing for $182 million to provide crucial assistance over the next 6 months in Nigeria. Much of the aid, it notes, will help people whose livelihoods and incomes have taken a big hit by COVID-19. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's it for this Wednesday, June 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington saying, have a good day.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.